Good morning. Thank you for coming. We're very pleased to be hosting Edward Luttwak today to talk about his new book, The Rise of China Versus the Logic of Strategy. A good book title tells you the entire book in about five words, and The Rise of China Versus the Logic of Strategy says quite a book, quite a bit about this book. Dr. Luttwak's book has already been well reviewed in a number of newspapers and journals. It referred to affectionately as the Little Red Book, although there's a bit of purple and blue as well. Ed Luttwak is a senior associate at CSIS and chairman of AP Fleet in Dublin, Ireland. He served as a consultant for the Secretary of Defense, for the NSC, and for different departments and services within the Pentagon, and is a frequent lecturer and author and commentator on all issues in foreign affairs and national security, but particularly military strategy and grand strategy. His first big book on grand strategy, Grand Strategy of the Roman Empire, is a terrific book. I'm writing my own history of grand strategy of the United States, and it's a model. And he's written on the grand strategy of the Ottoman Empire, and then a general treatise, Strategy, the Logic of War and Peace. So he comes to this as a proficient author on strategy, military strategy, grand strategy. And we'll ask Dr. Luttwak to introduce the book to us, and then we'll turn to the Freeman Chair in China Studies at CSIS, my colleague to the left here, Chris Johnson, and we'll then open it up for some discussion from the floor. So, Edward, thank you, and we look forward to hearing about the book.
Yes. Here at CSIS, there are some real sinologists, that is, people who have studied Chinese language and culture for many years and so on. I, on the other hand, I'm not at all a sinologist. And the reason this book came into existence is because I have been a kind of military tourist in China since 1976. I was part of a small group of Americans who were specialists in very narrow kinds of military knowledge, very narrow, very technical, who were invited to China by Marshal Ye Chenin. Subsequently, Marshal Ye Chenin, of course, established the institution that I know as the Academy of Military Sciences. What is the Chinese? Yeah, no, but in Chinese, the Potonghua. Yeah, this institution, which is a sort of brain institution for the People's Liberation Army in Beijing, they actually use my textbook on strategy as their textbook. They translated it and published it and already many years ago. And because of this connection, and because of the fact that I really like China, I have been, over the many years, ever since then, traveling around China, visiting military institutions, dealing with military officers, and they have been also coming to visit me, to my house, and have dinner and so on. My wife always gives them brisket. Brisket is a solid piece of meat like this, and they like it. So, and then one day, somebody in the Pentagon, the legendary person called Andrew Marshall, who is 90 years old, also known as Yoda or other mysterious names, he called me and he said, can you do a book about Chinese strategy? So I said, no, I can't. First of all, I'm not a sinologist. I'm an alphabet, cannot read and write Chinese and so on. But then, you know, he kind of pushed me, so I tried to do it. Then I discovered that even if I was willing to do it, there was no such thing as Chinese strategy. What there was is behavior. Behavior generated both, like in any other place, by culture, by attitudes, by hopes, fears of the moment, and by bureaucratic institutional structure. While I was doing this, I suddenly realized that the thing I was looking at was changing. Because we're now talking the last 5 years. Suddenly changed behavior. It started, I remember when the Bank of China representative in Manila, the Asian Development Bank, suddenly announced that the China would vote against a certain aid package to India, an investment package, which included a road in what the Indians called Arunachal Pradesh, which is the old Northeast Frontier Agency, Northeast India. This piece of territory, because the Chinese representatives said, this is not Indian territory, this belongs to China. And they said, this is South Tibet. Now, this territorial position has not changed, of course, since the 1960s, but it was complete silence. Nobody talked about it. Suddenly, bang, he stares and he announces, no, you cannot build a road there. This is not India, it's China. This was news to the Indians, or at least at the public level, media level, and so on. The government, of course, knew about the claim. And it was the beginning of a series of such claims. None of them original new claims, but all of them dormant, sleeping, not mentioned, not discussed, not talked about. And you know what they are. It is the sparkly paracels, the Xinsha, Shansha, they call them and so on, with Vietnam, claim on the offshore water of Indonesia, off the Natuna Island, which is not a rock, but a place where there's a big natural gas installation. There is a claim, of course, in regard to the Philippines. And if you look at those of you who like scuba diving are familiar with this part of the Philippines because it's really got wonderful coral and fish. And you're standing there, and here you look to the right, and is Philippine mainland territory. And the nearest Chinese territory is 700 kilometers. But the Chinese claim is that this is Chinese territory with the Philippines. And, of course, in regard even to Korea, there is a claim to the continental shelf. There is no, in the case of Vietnam, as you know, Paracels and Spratly, these are not islands. These are rocks. These are coral reefs. These are shoals, sandbanks. In regard to Korea, it is a rock underwater, which is claimed. So in this case, you cannot say that Chinese fishermen have been sleeping there overnight since centuries. It's underwater. And then, of course, Senkaku. So the book, I finished the book 2 years ago, but the book is full of these incidents which happened last year. And the reason is not that I am a prophet. As I say, if you read the book, you read all the stuff which is happening now, or at least happened last year, and the book was finished. Takes, you know, a long time for a book to be printed by Harvard Press. They hesitate a lot about the cover, you know, should it be red or pink and so on. And the reason I was able to write about these incidents 2 years ago, before actually they had all started, but they didn't become dramatic, was because everything was so predictable, so predictable. When you look at the situation, what you see is not something new, not something original, not something Chinese, only Chinese, special Chinese. What you see is something completely familiar. And it is the well-known infernal machine. The infernal machine, which is public opinion from the bottom up. Precisely when people feel better, when people are not hungry anymore, they have food, they have this, their decent life, moving into apartments and so on. At that time, when you think people should be relaxing, that's when people start pulling up old resentments and all anger about the past when China was very weak, and the memories, personal memories, family memories, imagined memories, memories taught in schools, memories in films and documentaries of how foreigners were trampling China and doing and so on. Famous American actors going up the Yangtze River and shooting people, and of course, great many non-famous Japanese trampling the territory. This is bottom-up resentment. We have seen this happen in country after country, in different cultures, in different historical periods. When the situation improves, instead of people saying, wonderful, now I have food, now I have somewhere to live, let me relax, instead people get angry. everybody knows the story, okay? In Germany, precisely in the 1890s, when industrialization made Germany very rich compared to the past and strong and advanced, suddenly the Germans got angry. They started remembering that in the previous centuries, foreign armies were invading Germany and burning cities and so on. It's a familiar phenomenon, bottom up. Top down, the government must encourage this type of activism, this type of claim, this type of noisemaking. I mean by government, I mean the top leadership. They have no alternative to that. If you are running the Communist Party of China, and you have power because you run the Communist Party of China, when communism doesn't exist anymore, it is not a joke. There are more communists in Italy. Now, in Italy, in the Italian election of today, the real hardline Communist Party, hammer and sickle, will probably win 4 or 5% of the vote. There are more communists in Italy than in China. That is certain, absolutely certain, believing communists. So you don't have believing communists. You have the alternative, which is nationalism. Nationalism. Instead of telling people, quiet down, forget about it, you hit the nationalist drum. You hit the drum, you wave the flag, you say, you know, these Senkaku is our islands. Diaotai, of course, is not called Senkaku in Chinese. Our islands and so on. So you have bottom up resentment and anger, which can be directed away from other issues, from the top down, which is encouragement of nationalist attitudes and nationalist language and nationalist behavior and noisemaking. And then you have horizontal pressure. You have the pressure from the different institutions that are involved in this process. The incidents with Vietnam have not been caused by the People's Liberation Army, Navy. They have not been caused by the Air Force. They have not been caused by the Army. Actually, the territory between the border between Vietnam and China is fully delimited post by post. It's a process that did take many years and was very, very difficult process, but it's completely delimited. There is absolutely no territorial claim on land. The Army is silent. Here in Vietnam, it is chiefly two elements. The fisheries, the law enforcement section of the fisheries administration. They have their own fleet. They have about a couple of hundred boats and ships. Some of them are not small. Some of them are 4,000-ton displacement. The leader of this organization likes to make speeches that he needs more ships and more boats and bigger ships. And this organization is the one which has been systematically causing the incidents in Vietnam, arresting Vietnamese fishermen, taking their nets, claiming this rock and that reef, and occupying, of course, many years ago, the Paracels. In the case of Japan, on the other hand, the prominent organization was not, again, the Navy. It was the what we call in English CMS, the Maritime Surveillance Organization. Again, they have their own fleet, a couple of hundred boats and ships. They also speak and they say they need more ships and bigger ships. And they're the ones who have been causing the incidents in the Senkaku Islands and very aggressively. Other people got involved, but they've been the protagonist of it. So what we have here, and then, of course, we do have, in regard to the Indian border, we have the, I would not even say the PLA army, I would say the Chengdu military region people. Because if you look at the India-China scene, you are seeing a two schizophrenic two pictures. Picture number one, quite good diplomatic relations, constant exchanges, visits from officials to Beijing and Indian officials to Beijing, Chinese officials there, negotiating border agreements, not to settle the dispute that cannot be done by officials, but arrangements to avoid incidents, to communicate incidents, to have deconflicting, it's called mitigation and so on. And they are signing, they've signed many agreements, memoranda, And they get along very well with each other. The Indian National Security Advisor, Shiv Shankar Menon, was the Indian ambassador to Beijing. The current Indian ambassador to Beijing, Jai Shankar, is a very prominent strategic thinker, and they're very sophisticated. The Chinese counterparts have been very forthcoming. And all along, there are hundreds of incidents, hundreds of border incidents. With the Chengdu military region, they don't care what is signed in Delhi with the memorandum. They are doing a lot of aggressive patrolling. And it happens quite often that the Indian patrol goes out and finds that the Chinese patrol is behind them and there is some tension. And the result is that the Indian military presence has continues to be increased. They have a corps, they have three divisions. And those of you who like to travel, I recommend you visit the area. And the Indian 4th Mountain Division in Tenga has the most beautiful military base in the world, surrounded by glaciers and mountains with running water. And the food is very good, too. You know, they have excellent cooks there. So go to Tenga, and what you see in Tenga is the number of troops on that border keeps increasing. The more they sign agreements, and so on. Then there is the question of the foreign ministry. If you follow the foreign ministry behavior during the Senkaku incident, you will realize that their interpretation of their job was not to calm things down or to explain, but to incite. They issued very, very aggressive statements. And I remember even when the matter was resolved with the release of the drunken fishing boat captain who caused the original incident back then, the foreign ministry immediately came out, now we want compensation. Of course, there was no compensation. That was just words. But the way they did it and so on. But those of you who are familiar with these people know that you don't actually have to listen to the word, because there's been a change in body language. One of the people in the foreign ministry is a vice minister who is really a very elegant lady, and she was and still is very elegant, but before she was elegant in a kind of ladylike way, and now she moves around as if she was a Mongol horseman. When she speaks, you know, she says, wow, 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 you know, that kind of stuff. Now, she is of Mongol ethnic origin, but I'm sure that's a mere coincidence. Now, when you go to Beijing and you start talking in this way to old friends, people who have been involved in this process for many years, people like Jane Bijan, the author of Peaceful Rise and so on, he does not say that this doesn't exist. What he says is there are many elements, there are many groups, people are pushing, they're pulling, there is emotion, there is public opinion, there is Weibo, there is adjustment. The foreign ministry is getting envelopes in a mail containing calcium pills, that you need calcium for your backbone to be tougher and so on. Says, this is real life of China, which is changing every day. There are phenomena of democratization going on. There are phenomena of repression going on. There is enterprise, there is bureaucratic competition. Remember that when Hu Jintao came here, Jen Bijan came with him. And in the White House pictures, you see Hu Jintao, and behind Hu Jintao, very tall, white hair, is that Jen Bijan. 3 days, a week before he came, he shared the agenda of the visit, of the Hu Jintao visit. He shared it with an American visitor who was in his house in the usual way of many years. And, you know, this agenda was, of course, an agenda about improving relations, cooperation, and stability, and so on and so forth. The 3 days before Hu Jintao arrived, in Chengdu, the fighter aircraft production company showed the new J-20 fighter. In that factory in Chengdu, they have two airstrips. One airstrip is to the left, one to the right. The one to the right is next to the big road, what you call an American freeway. And they parked this airplane right next to the road, so everybody passing could take pictures. of the new super stealth fighter prototype. Now, all of this, and Jen Bijan's answer about this is nobody consulted us. Okay? Flat out. So we have all of these phenomena taking place, and now there are two questions. One is, when will an incident get out of hand? Already, there are not only visits, but going around islands and doing and claiming and talking and acting in such a way that something could really happen, which is would be a very serious matter, because then consequences would start unfolding. But behind that, there is a question that perhaps you might enlighten me or somebody in the audience, and that is the question of public opinion in China and how it is actually structured. Because one gets the impression, and in my case, it's an impression through multiple filters, so I really don't know how right I am or completely wrong. One gets the impression that public opinion in China is not realistic about the balance of power. Public opinion in China does not realize that having demonstrating a first aircraft carrier is not the same as having a navy that can actually operate an aircraft carrier. Public opinion should be aware in China, as the whole world is aware and Americans are aware, that China is simply by economic growth and social development, cultural development, technical development, is becoming more and more powerful. But they are not aware of how long it takes before actually you are powerful enough to be able to manage conflict, manage an incident. So one has the impression that Chinese public opinion is putting pressure on the system because people don't realize that China is still very weak. Not only very weak, let's say, against the United States Navy, but very weak against the Japanese Navy. If there is a clash between the Chinese Navy and Japanese Navy, the Japanese Navy will sink the Chinese boats fast. And public opinion does not seem to realize that. There are two elements involved. One is that all of us, all of humanity, we always anticipate power. Money is discounted. If I promise you $1 million in 50 years' time, you will not give me a lot for this. But we anticipate power. We look at future power, and we bring it back to today. And secondly, there is, a cultural element here. And that is, I've seen behavior, not by intellectuals, not by officials, not by military officers, but by people on the street. I spent time in a tourist-infested area of China called Yangchuo, which is just full of tourists, always has been. I was there for other reasons. I watched Yangchuo people trying to cheat foreigners. And very often, they were sometimes doing quite well with the Scandinavian tourists and but I saw them trying to cheat a group of Italians. And the Italians were laughing, just laughing, saying, is this how you cheat? You really need help from us, you know. How you cheat tourists, you know. And what's behind it is this kind of what you might call the Shunzi phenomenon. You know, you read Shunzi, and you have this idea that we Chinese know how to deal with foreigners. We can outmaneuver them. We can manipulate them. We know how to, you know. And that could be a dangerous thing today, because it's a notion that you can start an incident, and then not to go to a war, but to provoke a resolution. In other words, you start an incident because the crisis starts a diplomatic process that then leads to a solution. And it is very unfortunate, extremely unfortunate, that this belief appears to be not quite present even among officials, which is this notion that when you start an incident, you see, when human beings start an incident, they have certain intentions. But what happens is never what they intend, because life is very cruel. Very different things happen. But they have this belief. And if you remember a book which I really do not like at all, which is the Kissinger book on China, written by I don't know who, certainly not him. In that book, he begins by quoting, the author quotes Mao Zedong, Mao Zedong, who says, I am starting the incident in, then we're talking October 1962, that's how the book begins, starting the incident with India, not to start a war. We will be friends with India. No, it's just to persuade them to go to the negotiating table. So the October 1962 attack against the Indians was designed to persuade them to go to the negotiating table, to discuss the territorial border in Arunachal Pradesh, of course, Aksai Chin and so on. The result of this is that there's never been the possibility of negotiating a territorial agreement. But this belief that you can manipulate and control, you know, these are barbarians, we know how to handle them. And we have Shunze, and they don't have Shunze, and Shunze is very clever and so on. Well, let me tell you, Clausewitz was more clever and not clever enough to control incidents. So I will stop right now, and thank you for listening, and I'll be happy for...
Thank you very much, Edward, for that very stimulating discussion. It's hard to follow up on that. Let me just highlight a couple of things that I think you touched on that are really interesting and valuable in the current context. Especially, I'm struck by both what's in the book and then what you just said about this idea of grand strategy in China and the absence thereof, and then how that leads these institutional actors and the cultural aspects to really become the driver of the process, and yet a very firm sort of understanding and idea as well, though, that the Chinese take the long view on everything. They're inscrutable in the way that they look at things. And there is this Sunza overlaying strategy, right, that kind of governs everything. And so I would just submit to amplify one of the points that you made, that the absence of that strategic lens, if you will, allows for a larger role for these competing bureaucratic actors that you talked about, especially in a much more pluralized setting that they're in now, as the Communist Party loses control increasingly over this dynamic society, not in the sense of overall total control and that the party will fail, but that its ability to constrain these actors is much more limited in the current context. And so what we see instead is these increasingly powerful fiefdoms operating in a way that suits them best to their bureaucratic interests, and then is unfortunately oftentimes interpreted by outside actors as a master plan, when in fact it's all simply poor coordination oftentimes within the system or no coordination at all. So that's a very important point. I certainly take your point about nationalism taking the place of communism. I mean, we've seen this now for some time that for as long as I can remember, certainly through the reform period, the two pillars that the regime has used to legitimize itself are delivering economic growth and increasingly the nationalism. And that's to make up for the absence of communist ideology. But one thing that I think is missing, at least in your opening remarks, and I'd welcome hearing more from you on it, is even though there aren't many communists left in the Chinese Communist Party, there is still a strong Leninist feel to the party in the way that it operates. And that, I think, drives them in certain directions and does provide sort of an overarching philosophy anyway, or a guiding theme for how they do things. I agree with your argument that it is very much an internally focused thing. You know, in other words, their foreign policy isn't always governed by this. But they do, for example, put high value on having a line, a foreign policy line. We saw this debate in the aftermath of the global financial crisis, where there was a substantial internal debate over what to do about the so-called Biden-Hyde guidance of Deng Xiaoping, you know, and should China instead adopt this much more assertive posture that you've been talking about. So in other words, I don't want to suggest that it's simply chaos inside the system, right, and these various bureaucratic actors are angling for advantage. There is a top-level design, as they put it in Chinese, and I think that this has been sort of delayed, if you will, by the pressures that they've been facing of the leadership transition that they've just gone through. But now that they're increasingly wrapping that up, it'll be done here next month when Xi Jinping takes over his formal positions and so on, I would expect them to launch an internal process to think about whether or not they need a new foreign policy line, a guiding foreign policy line. And they do have certain strategic guidelines, such as the so-called period of strategic opportunity that they say is operating through 2020, that act as a guide, I think, for what they do. So I think, and I don't think this is your intention, but just to clarify my own view, I don't think it's that it's you know, helpful to suggest that it's just chaos inside the system when it comes to foreign policy making. A second point, I think,
The Leninist thing, you're absolutely correct, but what Leninism means is simply a system of discipline.
Right.
Discipline.
Right.
Leninism means that everybody will follow the line, one. Two, that the line is not just arbitrarily ordered by an emperor or something, but is presented by the leader. Yes, he's the leader, but he has to explain the reasons for it in a systematic
democratic
way to the others. He explains it. They have to accept it and follow it, but he has to explain the line, and it is true. However, there is also the question of command and control, okay? Because if you go back to the incident of April 1, 2001, which is the Hainan incident, when a pilot Wang, actually, came up and collided with the P-3 and so on, there was enough information generated to know that nobody in Beijing had either wanted that incident or B, had ever authorized this kind of patrolling, very aggressive patrolling of coming right up to the P-3 and taking, the pilot used to take pictures of him waving and so on. So he emailed his email address on a piece of paper and so on. So there is Leninism, but there is not detailed command and control, partly because the Ministry of Defense, as you know, is not an actual Ministry of Defense. It is a diplomatic body. There is no general military headquarters. There are only military region headquarters. The Central Military Commission does not have a big staff. And we know that, I mean, my friends from the AMS are always running back and forth to the Central Military Commission to do reports, okay? So there is Leninism in line. Now, in regard to the question about looking at consequences and maybe changing the line, I believe that there was exactly this at the end of 2011. At the end of 2011, there was a big sit-down saying, look, all these incidents.
Right.
And so on, and people thought they would therefore stop, but they didn't. So, thank you.
No, those are great points, and it leads exactly to my next one, which is I think the reason why it didn't stop was this issue of public opinion, right, and the increasing role that it's playing in shaping that debate. 10 years ago, if you'd asked me, when the Chinese foreign ministry comes out and says, well, to the U.S. or any other foreign actor, we'd love to help you on issue X, but the Chinese public just won't let us get away with it, I would have said, you know, don't listen to that. They're in control and so on. What was striking, and I think really the first episode of this, I'm glad you raised it, was the previous Senkaku episode when they had the boat collision. And in that instance, it was very clear the way in which public opinion narrowed the policy response spectrum to a very tight spectrum between, in my mind, very strong responses, which we saw, and conflict. And you can make the case that if the Japanese had not basically caved at the time and released this shipboat cabinet, there might have been, you know, a conflict very quickly. And I think the other issue here is that I agree there was that turnaround in 2011, but I think the pressure of the public opinion means that debate's not done. You know, what's interesting is that I think a lot of people concluded wrongly at that time that, well, Hu Jintao and Dai Bingguo and other very senior actors in the system have commented on this publicly and have issued speeches and have, you know, internally warned everyone that we need to have, you know, more coordination on this and so on, and that meant somehow the debate was settled, that they were going to stick forever with Deng Xiaoping's Biden headline. I don't think so. You know, I think that the debate was artificially suppressed in part for the need for social stability and internal stability ahead of the leadership transition, but then secondarily as well, because they did realize they were having a lot of these negative effects. But what's striking is the speed with which the issues come right back to the fore, you know, and we're grappling with it again. And I think we will continue to grapple with it as long as you point out, there's this disconnect between the public's understanding of Chinese rising power and the actual balance of power, you know, and the strong disconnect between those two. I think it doesn't just, I would argue and add, and I'm sure you would support this, but it doesn't just come out of the public. You know, I mean, a lot of people in Chinese officialdom believe this as well, especially in the PLA. I mean, you know, my sense is that there's a strong sense in the Chinese military that they do have much increased capability. And there's a disconnect between, you know, a military that hasn't been bloodied in, you know, about 30 years and one that is increasingly, though, technically proficient and lethal in its ability to project force externally. And then just a concluding point so we can get into a broader discussion. I see where time is moving along. It's just this idea that of provoking, you know, going to war to provoke an incident that then leads to a diplomatic solution. I think that's a very keen insight because, and the book talks about this principle as well, that applying the rules of internal Chinese statecraft, you know, competition among elites and so on, to the external environment is a very dangerous game, especially in an era where, like I mentioned just a moment ago, you could get away with this 20 years ago. Now, when the PLA swings its arms in the region, it's much more likely to hit something and bloody it. And that's something that the central leadership, I think, is really grappling with. And just in closing, I think short of structural solutions to this problem of internal coordination, real structural solutions, it's going to continue to manifest itself. It doesn't really matter how many specific edicts or general pronouncements the top leadership makes. If they don't make some structural adjustments to the current kind of stovepipe Leninist structure that's trying to govern this increasingly dynamic society, I think they're going to continue to face these problems.
Edward, let me ask a question before I turn to the audience, if that's all right, too. Just to, you know, provoke you to elaborate a little bit on a few points, you argue in the book that China does not have a grand strategy, in effect. But does China have a military strategy? Does the PLA have a military strategy? It seems to me that not unlike Japan in the 30s, China has a military strategy. It has its flaws, but it's a determined military strategy with end ways and means, resulting in problems for us operationally like A2AD and so forth. But that military strategy is at odds with their grand strategy. And could you clarify that? And the second point is, I come away from the book and the discussion a little unsure whether this is a Mearsheimer situation where structurally we're just not going to be able to avoid conflict, or whether because these different elements of Chinese grand strategy, diplomatic, military, economic, are increasingly at odds. You can't pursue A2AD and charm your way into a Sinocentric East Asian order. And so is it Mearsheimer or is there going to be learned behavior? I mean, I'm thinking of your other books and my own study of history. I mean, Bismarck, after the Franco-Prussian War, imposed restraint on German grand strategy without creating a new structure or a new NSC. Theodore Roosevelt did it after the Spanish-American War and imposed some restraint on American grand strategy to avoid counterbalancing without creating a new NSC. So, you know, is there a Bismarck or a Teddy Roosevelt that could emerge, and there could there be learned behavior where the grand strategy moderates, or are we on a truly dangerous path? So if you could elaborate on those two, and then I'll
open. There was certainly an attempt, I think you alluded to it. Dai Bingguo came out with a programmatic, it was a very programmatic document spelling out a successful strategy for China that would involve long-term development, managing conflict, avoiding conflict, dealing with confrontation. And I went around the AMS and I asked the two stars, the major generals, the people, I said, what do you think of this document? And the answer is, oh, it was 7,000 characters. It was too long. Somebody else said, no, it wasn't 7,000. It was 10,000 characters. And yes, it was much too long. I just read the first few words. Okay? So there's definitely a knowledge that Leninist discipline has to be articulated and expressed, and in a constructive way, exactly like you said, which is restraints, balance for the success of the country in the advance. But it is not reflected in behavior. So Dai Bingguo himself flies to Manila with Dai Bingde, the defense minister, to have a goodwill mission the day before MiG-29 is buzzing some old little Filipino aircraft. And there was an incident before. In other words, there is definitely a shared, people like Dai Bingguo, they understand, and the leaders evidently, because he did not issue the document without full support of the Politburo, obviously. They know that there is a need for this, but they cannot actually, they do not have the command and control. Now, to the military. Do the military have a strategy? Well, I've encountered lots of it, but I encountered Air Force strategy. Air Force strategy is Navy people are stupid. They want to spend our money to build ridiculous aircraft carriers.
You're talking about us or them right now.
Yeah, both. We can sink all these aircraft carriers with one ballistic missile, the biggest aircraft carrier. The Navy has a strategy, which is China is a maritime nation. I did not know that. But they say it's a maritime nation. The Navy, by the way, sponsored a really gorgeous program on CCTV. The blue, did you see it?
Yeah.
Everything is in blue about China's a maritime nation with beautiful people dressed in blue and projecting the thing and sailboats and so on. The Navy believes that the Air Force are just time wasters because Navy means naval presence, influence, rescuing Chinese people in Africa and other places when they need, fighting piracy. This is the real thing, and the Air Force is useless because they can only come in if there is a war. And the Navy are very peaceful. They want to peacefully expand. And finally, there's the Army that is resentful at the fact that the Air Force is showing off beautiful aircraft, the Navy with the aircraft carrier, nobody looks at them, and actually, we are the basis of everything. Now, only public opinion, only one statement. If you are running a non-democratic system, you must have a police force that frightens the population. Yeah. And I have noticed, I myself was present when I saw a riot in Yunnan. And that wasn't a big riot, but there are riots like this every day. They overturned the police car. Mm-hmm. They set it on fire. And the police did not shoot. So when you don't have a democratic system, but your police cannot even shoot people when they overturn a police car, then you have to listen to public opinion. And the fact that the public opinion doesn't understand the balance of power and thinks that, for example, China could brush aside Japan, or B, believe that the Japanese can be frightened into abandoning things, you know, that is a real problem. Thank you.
Yeah, chime in with two quick comments. I think this is what you raised, and Edward's response really highlights this issue of the structural problem, right? You know, so there's two things there. The emergence of service identity within the PLA, which is a very important and understudied thing in my own assessment. I mean, you know, the Army is jealous of even the Second Artillery, which is supposed to be a, you know, support service, basically. All of the resources are being diverted in this direction. There are no shiny new tanks and so on for the Army. But more importantly, the Navy especially has defined its own, you know, military strategy in a lot of ways, and it's a very Mahanian strategy. And then there's the whole issue related to all this as well of an emerging Chinese military-industrial complex and the role that it plays in reinforcing a lot of this stuff as well. A military-industrial complex that's poorly controlled internally and poorly understood, I think, by the civilian leadership in terms of budget and all of that sort of thing. So there's some serious problems there.
So we'll know there's a joint military strategy when we see people dancing in purple on CCTV, right? I'm going to open it up for questions, but we've agreed to let our distinguished visiting fellow, Lu Shun, ask the first question and perhaps brief comment to Dr. Ludwig. There's a microphone right here.
Thank you, Nick, for giving me such an opportunity to...
Folks identify themselves, too?
Okay. I'm Lu Shun, a visiting fellow here from China. And Edward was the first man I visited after I came here. And actually, I admire him very much. And his work about ground strategy, I think it's not... Edward said he was not a sinologist, but actually I believe his work will make many sinologists envy to him. Yeah. So first, my comment and question will about Edward's thought on the paradox of strategy. Actually, in my understanding, he said in all strategic thinkings, in all strategies, there is a paradox. There is a paradox, and I generalize his thought of this to another concept, which is a paradox of power, which means for most powerful nations, their behavior to strengthen their power actually can hurt the power. Finally, yeah, in your study about the Roman Empire, we see this, and in the long history of China, we see many cases which can manifest the paradox of power. And so I think your recent work on China is a kind-hearted warning to China, which means that China should be more circumspect and cautious in its behavior relating to other countries. But I think the paradox of power is not only it's not a problem for only China. It's for all powerful nations in this world, especially no matter its existing great power or rising power. So I think the paradox of power is also a problem for the United States. It's for China and it's also for the United States. We know many years ago, people like experts like John Kennedy, spoke quite a lot about the overstretch of the American power, and now there are still people discussing the how can I say it's kind of a deficit of power of the United States, and I think there might be miscalculations on the two sides when they think about their own power. So I wanted to hear from Edward about the problem of overstretch, a possible overstretch, or for both the United States and China. Thank you.
I'm just a very important issue. It's in a book. I didn't want to talk about it. I wanted to choose. The argument here, paradox, is that my argument, and I think you understand fully the logic of it, is that if China was completely not aggressive, if they said, yes, we have these claims, these are really our territories, but we will not talk about it, which was the previous policy, if absolutely nobody talked about it, if instead of showing off aircraft carrier, China would say, we are different, we're going to invest in hospital ships to help the sick people in the world, and you did not project military strength, there would be overwhelming Chinese influence all around. Already, correct me if I'm wrong, our Japan expert here, but only 3 years ago, Mr. Ozawa in Japan was trying to lead Japan to become much more friendly to China and away from the United States. The normal thing is a rising China, which is buying so much, selling so much, investing so much, where so many people visit for so many different reasons. Such a China would quite naturally be very influential in all these places. Instead, what there is today, because of the feeling of threat, there is the coalition, also I didn't talk about, the emerging coalition between Japan, India, Vietnam, the Indians and the Vietnamese working together, submarine project, the Japanese giving help to the Philippines. There is an emerging, spontaneous, organic alliance forming against China. Now, in the case of the United States, after the end of the Cold War, when the Soviet Union collapsed, the United States remained there as a kind of only superpower. There were reactions to it. The French were going around saying, oh, this is hyper. They were trying to block. They were trying to resist. They were not our enemies, these people. They just felt America was too strong. They're so strong, their independence was prejudiced. So the paradox of power applies for everybody, and the logic of strategy applies to everybody always in every situation. And right now, the logic is expressed by the fact that without any coordination, any organization, any encouragement, really, certainly not from the United States, these countries, that each country that is now feels threatened by China, is finding ways of cooperating with each other in a way that is blocking Chinese influence. And in the case of Myanmar or Burma, you saw that Burma was in the Chinese sphere and leaves the Chinese sphere because the Burmese found themselves too close to a China that was too strong and too aggressive, so they decided to abandon that connection and open to the West. So that's the paradox of power is the exactly as you said, it's a kind-hearted book. I like China. I like China. I like China. And I think it's on the wrong path because of that.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Hi, Chen Weihua, China Daily. Yeah, I want to hope you shed light on two questions. One is, I mean, obviously, you know, this Tao Guangyanghui, China talked about staying low profile in the past, but then it's being likely accused of being not taking responsibility, playing its role in the world. And so China continued to abstain in the United Nations instead of vetoing, you know. So now there's gradually, you know, playing a role, and then it's likely to be accused of being too aggressive, too assertive. So what China should do, I mean, in this regard? I mean, is this because, I mean, this is a country identified by West as a communist? Even you said, Italian are more communist. the other question is, you know, about these territorial disputes. I mean, China, I mean, since the Opium War has kept ceding land, you know, never taking lands. So, I mean, every land dispute, it seems always China's wrong. I mean, even, you know, it's no in China's interest to wage war at any time in the coming decade. I wouldn't think any Chinese. I mean, there is nationalistic sentiment. I mean, talking about Diaoyu Island or what do you call it, Senkaku, whatever. Actually, Ma Ying-jeou in Taiwan is more sort of an activist on this issue. But no one talks about Ma Ying-jeou's view is wrong. Or, you know, and instead of saying, you know, the mainland is sort of aggressive, blah, 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 blah. So, I mean, you said certain islands is closer to Philippines. But I mean, Kerry, John Kerry is in London now. He's probably talking about the Falkland Islands, you know, if it belongs to Britain instead of Argentina. So what's wrong, you know, is that because the West has this particular view about China? Thank you.
Well, first of all, these reactions, the reactions that are causing this coalition are not Western reactions. Japanese public opinion is formed in Japan. Even in the Philippines, there was really the whole elite in Manila is actually ethnic Chinese elite. They all have Spanish names, and they're all Chinese origin. And they are very, or culturally, they were very pro-Chinese. They were resentful. They, of course, like the United States in some degree and admire, but they're also resentful of the American presence in the Philippines and were very happy to kick out the U.S. Navy and U.S. Air Force from the Philippines. What turned them against China was only the territorial issue and these activities, you know, when suddenly there are jet fighters flying and boats and incidents and claims and so on. So these are not Western attitudes. These are Filipino attitudes. The Indians, absolutely not influenced by anybody. What Americans think, it's an Indian thing, like it's a Japanese thing. So the Western, non-Western doesn't apply to this case. These are inter-Asian things. Secondly, everybody, and this, in a way, I'm aware of the contradiction, okay? I am Everybody in the East Asian arc, from Korea around to India, is very aware of the fact that China settled and negotiated every single territorial question with Mongolia, with the Soviet Union Russian Federation, with Kazakhstan, with Uzbekistan, and all of these were negotiated. There was also Pakistan, and even with Afghanistan, there was a negotiation. All of these negotiations were concluded successfully. In most cases, the Chinese gave up three quarters of their claim. And all of this was done very quietly without any problems. And then the other arc, instead of being settled, is the scene of these expressions. So that, you know, this is the real-life phenomenon. Now, in regard to the question of wanting China to be active or not active, see, this has to do with the question of size. Let's say you are in an elevator, okay? You and a group of people are in an elevator, and a very fat man enters. Now, he's very nice, very friendly, but he's very fat, and he's getting fatter by the minute, okay? Suddenly, you feel you're going to get squeezed against the walls. That fat man is an intelligent fellow, realizes that because he is getting fatter by the minute, he has to be really quiet and polite and not to sound aggressive at all. Somebody else comes into the elevator who's thin, he can shout and scream and people don't care because they can, you know, they don't feel squeezed by him. So awareness of size, awareness of importance leads to restraint. Now, the American case, and you mentioned, okay, I just want to recall a fact, which is that when the Bush administration started in 2001 they started, the National Security Advisor came out with a paper saying the United States must be humble, humble. Humility will be the position of the U.S. administration because we don't want to evoke the paradox, the reactions of others that will paralyze us. And then, of course, things took a different turn. Thank you.
I think there might have been a D at the end of the word when it was first put out. But, next question. Yes, sir.
George Nicholson with StratCorp. One of the things you haven't discussed is the PDRK in terms of what we can expect in the future and the best interest of China, of them helping to come up with a solution to that set. Are they concerned about implosion and refugees coming into China? Are they concerned about a unified Korea being a threat, no longer having a buffer? And again, with your insights, can we expect, you know, with what's happening and the concern about the aggressive nuclear program in North Korea, is there going to be more of a Chinese influence to try to help solve the issue?
Well, I like to hear from the real experts here, but I did notice that immediately after the detonation, there was in GT, in Global Times, there was an article by, I forget the name, but the person of some position, who said that North Korea is not a friend of China. This is absolutely wrong that they detonated a nuclear weapon and all that kind of stuff. So on that basis, a whole line of thinking started. The next day came out, or the day after, came out the official statement in the official news agency saying that the North Koreans detonated the nuclear device because they've been provoked by the Americans. They alarmed and frightened the Americans. So I would say there is definitely two positions in China. It's part of this settling down process and line finding. And I would say this. North Korea, at one level, North Korea is the fraternal country, okay, with whom there are very warm exchanges. And the other, there is a lot of alarm. I don't believe people in Beijing are any more calm about North Korea than anybody else is. There has also been the unwillingness to absolutely affect the situation. Unwillingness to affect the situation because China could, seriously put pressure there. Then again, South Korea, even under supposedly hardline president, continues to operate the Kaesong industrial area where they push money every day to North Korea, okay? So, I think there's a lot of inconclusiveness about it.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think, what we're confronting now with the latest provocation from the North are several things. I think, first of all, the Chinese internally, and I think that's what sparked this new renewed debate, they've had to come to the conclusion that their initial response and sort of position on how to deal with Kim Jong-un was completely wrong, that they felt that if they catered to him and tried to, sort of lean in that direction, that he would be more helpful than his father, and I think they've discovered that that was incorrect, largely because of the logic that drives the internal workings of North Korea. I think our colleague Victor Chow would say that. So this has provoked another round of this internal debate, internal discussion about, is North Korea really worth the effort and the trouble? They're troublesome. Should we keep doing what we've been doing? But it always does, that debate runs into the wall of the overarching geostrategic calculus that they seem to have settled on, which is that even though the regime is troublesome, it's better to have something called North Korea on that border as a strategic buffer between them and a unified South Korea, especially one that they would see under American auspices. This is even more pronounced after the switch with Myanmar/Burma, where they now think that 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 sort of flank is now exposed to Western influence, so we need the North even more. It's a very strong set of argumentation. The other thing is that, as Edward points out in his book, so much of Chinese foreign policy is actually designed by their concerns about what's going on internally. You know, Xi Jinping, as the new leader, is trying to convince internal forces to embark upon a reform program. He's going to need conservative support for that, and a lot of these conservative voices aren't going to want to see a switch in the DPRK policy. So I think the contrast between that Global Times piece that originally came out and then the Xinhua that followed up very quickly is a good reminder about the differences between Global Times and the official media. But
I spent way too much time in the Diaoyutai watching the North Koreans and Chinese hate each other to disagree with your argument on that front. And I think it points to this fundamental dilemma. A grand strategy is about mustering all the instruments of national power. A real shift in North Korea policy would involve a shift across the board in every ministry in local government, touching on pathological, sort of deep ideological questions. So I'm quite skeptical that the current little flickers of resentment at North Korea will result in a fundamental change in Chinese strategy. I've seen them before. It does raise this interesting question that you said earlier. You had an interesting exchange, the two of you, about whether China is Marxist or Leninist, and concluded they're Leninist, although not always very good at it. But I think there's a certain Marxist dimension in terms of a strategic view and analysis of the world that has a really sort of unmistakable dialectical materialism to it. And I think the Chinese view broadly towards the Korean Peninsula is a good example, that economic figures show more and more trade with the South, North Korea more and more dependent on the North. Why change policy? You know, the material factors demonstrate that China's influence over the whole peninsula will grow. And I think that explains, that same framework explains some of the faulty strategic thinking about Southeast Asia or Japan, because public opinion, soft power, those kinds of things don't come in to play when you're using a dialectical materialist approach. And maybe they're right on that, but I tend to think not. But that's one reason why we don't converge well strategically with China on North Korea. We haven't really since around 2003 or 4 when I was in the NSC. And in 2003, we did. The U.S. and China were at all levels, intel to intel, diplomatically, the president and Hu Jintao, we were clicking on North Korea policy because we were fighting about the tactics of the six-party talks. And once those talks started falling apart, we got to more fundamental strategic questions, and it became clear we didn't have the same long-term view in some respects. Okay.
Puchong Tsering from the International Campaign for Tibet. You mentioned about China's need to use nationalism as well as China's need to look at the public opinion. But I feel these two are interlinked. Public opinion feeds nationalism, and nationalism feeds public opinion. And these have negative impact on issues like Tibet. So how do you see China dealing with this dilemma?
Well, I think I was the first Westerner to visit Tibet, not with three other people, after 1949. And I've therefore been interested in Tibet ever since. As you know, the interaction between China and Tibet has many different dimensions. One of them is, for example, that the police that doesn't beat people up in Yunnan does beat them up in Tibet. Against the non-Han, you can hit Uyghur, Tibetans, maybe even Mongols in some case. Second is, of course, that Tibet has participated in the great economic advance of China, the richness, the money. And there, I believe that people like Hu Jintao personally were very surprised, very disappointed that, yes, they were not sufficiently advanced to be materialistic. Because China sent a lot of resources into Tibet, and instead of being used for the Tibetans to become modern people who are not interested in old things like religion, the money is flowing into monasteries. So monasteries that I visited in Qinghai that had 2 monks, 3 monks, now have 3,000 monks. This is very disappointing to the Chinese expectation that with money there would be modernization and so on. Also, the other thing is, and this tells you the limits of what's going on, is that the demonization of the Dalai Lama, making the Dalai Lama to be the greatest criminal and so on, has had the effect of making him the leader of parts of Tibet that never paid any attention to him. And also, the issue of repression, dictatorship, and brutality. You know, you drive in the Tibetan areas in Yunnan and Sichuan, and you pass these cafes, which don't have even doors, even though it's not hot at all there. They're big portraits of the Dalai Lama. You know, the Dalai Lama is supposed to be a criminal. How come there are big pictures there? So I asked the restaurant people, I said, what happens when the police come? They say, oh, they want the usual 20 yuan. They don't care. You know, there is everything negative and everything positive is impacting in Tibet in a sharpened way on it. I have to tell you that I am, my fundamental viewpoint of China is that I saw China when it was very poor, terribly poor, very sad, depressed, and so on. I'm personally happy to see it not so poor and much more cheerful, much happier, and much more dynamic, and so on. And I believe that in Tibet, the Tibetans have been winning completely. Because first, the spread of Dalai Lama influence in places among Tibetans who never even heard of him before, or at least did not hold him as the leader. Secondly, their identity has strengthened. Thirdly, they are recruiting Chinese groupies. There are, when you go now, there are plenty of Chinese groupies hanging around there. So I'm not concerned about Tibet. You just have to be patient. It might take another 50 years. But the future is on that side.
Gil?
I'm Gil Rosman from Princeton University, and I have a question about the dichotomy between sort of grand strategy at the top and bottom-up thinking. And I think much of the discussion has been trying to probe what's in between. And I think if you go back to 2009, at least, maybe a little earlier, you find a change in the coverage in China of many of the issues that arouse the bottom-up nationalism you're discussing. So whether it's Japan, where there was this abrupt change after 2008, or North Korea. So I would say look also at something in between, the shaping top-down through leadership and through the academic community, such as CAS, which became much more leftist, of public opinion on so many of the issues that have aroused the people. Is that part of your consideration of what is some sort of maybe an implicit grand strategy associated with identity?
This is where a non-sinologist like myself differs, because that is where I'm weakest. But I will make only one comment. In that middle echelon, one of the players are the regional governments. And I believe that who is responsible for losing, you know, Burma, losing Myanmar, was not Beijing, but was Kunming provincial authorities that kept pushing to extract resources. And I believe that the Chinese ambassador was telling, you know, we need to slow, 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 and nobody paid attention. And the belief, in regard to Jilin, the only time I visited there, I did hear a member of the leadership there say that we are Koreans ourselves, ethnic Korean, Jilin. We love Korea so much, we want two of them. Second, he said, however, if there was one Korea, then we would get the export-import trade with Korea, and we would not be getting Korean goods coming to us from the ports in other provinces. And both, so I believe that in that middle echelon, the regional authorities play a role, you know.
No, I would absolutely agree with that, and I think that's another part of this problematic pluralism that's been emerging, you know, within the system. And this problem goes back well before what we've seen in the last couple of years. As early as 2006, Hu Jintao called a foreign affairs work conference, which they don't do very often, to kind of get at this exact idea. And they brought all the provincial chieftains, they brought all the state-owned enterprise guys, all these people who are acting as pluralistic actors in Africa, Latin America, all these other places, and causing a lot of the problems that you've described in the book and in your talk about the soft power issue and about reputationally. This is why the Zheng Bijian is so frustrated about the failure of Peaceful Rise, is that, you know, they haven't been able to manage that process. And also comes back to something that Mike said earlier, which is that this and what the gentleman asked in regard to what should China be doing, you know, internationally. It's this idea that their approach externally is always transactional. You know, there isn't a soft power element to what they do, or at least it's not perceived that way. I'm sure it's very frustrating for China because a lot of what they do is in a very, you know, classic development assistance sort of way, and yet they don't get the credit for it in a lot of these places. And I think it is because there's this very strong sense that they're neo-mercantilist. They're, you know, that there's a strong transactional piece underlying it all, and it is reinforced by the behavior of a lot of those mid-level echelons in the system, and the top doesn't seem to be able to fully control them. You know, this was that event in 2006. You read the speech that Hu Jintao gave. It was a very direct, you know, and powerful sort of message to these guys. Didn't dent it a bit.
Yes, sir. You've been patient.
Hi, I'm Mr. Lloyd from Baltimore. With the recent boiling issue in the South China Sea or West Philippine Sea, and today, the Philippine government is celebrating this 27th anniversary of the People Power Revolution that kicked out Marcos 27 years ago. And the U.S. is largely a strong help in that brought Marcos to Hawaii. And today, many Philippine senators and congressmen are opening up the idea once again to have the U.S. naval base and the air base back to the Philippines, but not anymore in Luzon, which is very volcanic. But this time, it would be in the south, the area facing Malaysia. Do you see any possibility of opening up the fact that there are U.S. visiting forces agreement with the Philippines and the United States right now? Is there any plan that on the part of the U.S. as far as you see it, that a military base would once again be established in that area?
Well, you know, the day when the Philippine Senate voted to end the base presence in, to kick out the huge American naval base, which was not just a base, it was a city, it was an industry, it was a gigantic thing. The day the Filipino Senate voted, they actually passed only by one vote. However, there was widespread joy and happiness around Manila, not around the base because people lost their jobs and so on, because they felt that this was a coming of age and because of the heaviness of this American military presence there. That was very oppressive to the Filipino sense of identity and independence. Now, we are in a different world. And in this different world, as you know, the Philippine government says we want to have the American naval presence. The U.S. Navy has already had several visits in Manila Bay with the aircraft carrier task groups. And your suggestion that this time they should go to Mindanao is a very interesting one. And I suggest you send it to them. I tell you, the U.S. Navy, all of the culture of the U.S. Navy is that they would love to be back in the Philippines. But this is an example of what happens. 5 years ago, nobody would have proposed such a thing. 5 years ago, the notion is the Philippines does not need it. Nobody's threatening. China is rising. China will provide security, anti-piracy, and so on. Looking forward not to Chinese naval base, but to the arrival of Chinese power is stabilizing the area. This is exactly your statement, your question, your presence. It tells you the price, the paradox of being, you're less powerful because you are more powerful.
We did a study on this at CSIS. You can find on our website that was quite comprehensive. U.S. basing in Asia in general. We're not looking for a lot of new bases. But we are, I think, in a good position to work out a lot more access arrangements, a lot more joint training, and a lot more engagement across the whole region, including with Beijing. And I think that's probably the thrust of what the U.S. will do, particularly since very few countries can afford the generous host nation support that Japan and Korea pay, and neither can we.
It's Zhang Zhu with the Legal Daily of China. Thank you very much. As we know, Japanese Prime Minister Abe is gone after the visit, though he said he's back, just right here, this back. I think during his speech that he said during 1895 to 1971, there's no challenge over Senkaku or Diaoyu Islands. I suppose he may forget the Potsdam Declaration in 1945. I mean, here, the United States contributed a lot to the Second World War for the victory, and so maybe it's natural for the people here think the post-World War order is quite good and fair enough. But we do have some, you know, disputes or issues unresolved left by the World War. So I wonder, how do you look at the historical factor, you know, relating to the disputes in the region? And how could U.S. to deal with China to encourage for seeking a better behavior? Because these historical issues, I think, will not only affect, may even shape China's behavior, not only China, but other countries in this area. Thank you very much.
Right. Chinese side is, if I were Chinese, I would prefer to have influence over the whole of Japan through pro-Chinese politicians in Japan, rather than to have some little, very small, little rocky islands. Myself, all of, so that would be, you know, the perspective that I have on this. And it, the issue of post-war arrangements, post-Potsdam regimes of this kind, this is the kind of argumentation that looks as if there was a kind of judicial process involved. That if I find a document, you know, what would happen tomorrow if I find a document signed by, you know, the Japanese emperor saying that all of Ryukyu actually belong to China? What difference would it make to anything? But these things come about when countries enter in a certain relationship. As for the United States, I am convinced that we should be standing back. We should never be forward. That we should not advocate any kind of coalition against China. That we should not offer any kind of NATO. That we should just loyally support our allies when under pressure, including the Philippines, with which we have a security treaty, of course. And our new allies, like Vietnam, which are de facto allies. We have U.S. Navy ships being repaired in Vietnamese ports as we speak right now. We loyally support them, never to be in front of them, never to provoke them, never to us provoke. And but I would like to hear your take on this, since you're the Japan expert here.
No, I think that's smart grand strategy. And the only tricky thing for us, and we're not always very good at it, and recently we've been particularly wobbly, is that that requires a certain discipline in our system. And when you have certain U.S. officials saying we are strictly neutral on the Senkaku issue, and others saying we will oppose unilateral coercion, and then on Tuesday something else, there's a certain indiscipline in our declaratory policy, which is somewhat typical for the United States. But if we're going to get our grand strategy right and implement basically what you've said, we've got to have a much more disciplined process over our declaratory policy on these issues. Speak softly, carry a big stick. One more question. I want to, let's see.
Dr. Malcolm Davis, Bond University, Australia. My question relates to your point in the book about behavioral shift after the 2008 global financial crisis. You mentioned how China became a lot more assertive and not quite aggressive, but certainly assertive. And then Chinese Foreign Ministry had to dial it back by basically reasserting Deng Xiaoping's bide your time and hide your strength approach and also peaceful development towards a harmonious world. My question relates to the potential for a future global financial crisis possibly emerging out of Europe, which is yet to resolve its problems, and also potentially the United States, which, you know, we're talking about sequestration occurring at the end of this week. Well, that will not solve debt problems at all in the long term. How does China respond to a second global financial crisis potentially in the next few years? Will it become once again more assertive on the basis of an already more nationalist government? Thank you.
Yeah, by the way, in the book you've seen, I gave importance to Australia's role as the weaving together, bringing in the Malaysians and other people that the Americans only talk to. It's been a very active Australian diplomacy, even though Australia is a huge exporter to China, and even though at the Carlton Towers in Melbourne, half the people losing hundreds of millions of dollars at the gaming tables are Chinese and not Americans, the Australians, in a very disinterested way, are doing a lot of coalition building and so on. But in regard to the, first of all, I did not originate at all this idea that the financial crisis caused a change in behavior. I followed what was then already the established consensus in the China watching community and so on. This could be wrong, but it was, you know, observation. And secondly, things like the sequestration crisis tell you why people around the world are not intimidated by the United States, or at least some of them are, but mostly they're not. America is also the very fat man in the elevator, but people are not frightened of this fat man because this fat man is so obviously divided, you know, is always uncertain and changing his mind, going back and forth and so on. You know, sequestration crisis tells you that the Americans are basically not very sinister, you know, they're not, because they're not very coherent and so on. If we have the debt crisis unresolved in the United States and in Europe, from the Chinese point of view, you can predict, or at least you can hope, that there will be continued relative economic growth. That is, Chinese economic growth will continue to be much faster than European and American. And even without being a Marxist, that must change the balance of power over time. And that is the additional reason why, you know, China should adopt the JMB Jan line. And wait, you know, wait for all good things to come. But human beings never do that. If human beings behaved in that way, human history would be entirely different from the way it is. Much less interesting, much more quiet.
Well, in 90 minutes, we have solved the China problem. So I think, Chris, this is the last conference we'll have on China and Washington. So yeah. You were here. Let's encourage you to read the book. The country-by-country chapters are really interesting. Korea, which we didn't discuss, gets really hit. But I'll just leave that as a teaser for people to read, South Korea, for people to read the book. So we'll conclude by thanking Edward and congratulating him on this terrific volume.